regular topic.
Single outrage of my time, and that was the deportation of the Japanese and Japanese Americans on the West Coast into concentration camps without trial or hearing. Believe it or not, Justice Black held that this was legitimate in the service of military security, which argues that even a good judge like that finds himself under these pressures appropriate to a military or a garrison state. I presume that Justice Black's position is that he watches the thermometer, and in a cold war, you don't have to do what you do in a hot war. Anyway, he is now a supporter of a more liberal interpretation of rights. In other words, we have this situation of a garrison state, and I see no remedy. I see that we can keep up a fight and win some victories, but I do not think it possible, given history, what history teaches, what we know of human nature, to imagine that we can continue this Cold War indefinitely and not get deeper and deeper into the status of the garrison state. I do not, therefore, blame individuals primarily. There may be times you want to blame individuals. I am not blaming the military as a group because they are military, or even industrialists, the large industrialists. It is what's bound to happen as long as we have this kind of a society under the pressures of the garrison state. What happens is emphasized by the general acceptance now in the United States, what your fathers, maybe your grandfathers, would have thought incredible. A great many of them came to this country to escape the dominance of conscription. Yet we accept quite docilely and without even demands for certain revisions the current draft laws, which will be up for a renewal, I believe, this spring. I am not now arguing, you can tell me all you want, that you have to have them. I am saying if you have to have them, it's because you have to have a garrison state in some degree. I am saying that the pressures put on for shelters, everybody building shelters, and the mentality that goes with it, this tends to emphasize the aspect of the garrison state in the United States. And the reason I dwell on this perhaps longer than I should is because it's so largely ignored. Mark you, I am not saying that we are going to abolish the forms of democracy. I don't think it's going to be necessary because, to some extent, I agree with Arthur Schlesinger that at times the administration is more liberal than it thinks its supporters will be. That is to say that it needs a left, which I don't see him doing much to help us get. Well, anyway, here's the reason that I am calling your attention to the price we pay in the name of democracy for a process that even if, as I think is wholly unlikely, you will indefinitely avoid war by increasing military expenditures in the Cold War, even so, you will get deeper and deeper, perhaps beyond your conscious awareness, into the garrison state. And I will go a little farther and say that I think it quite possible, though by no means certain, that the kind of thing which is described in that best-selling book, 7 Days in May, could happen. That is to say that conceivably you could get us to a point where if a president signed a disarmament treaty or for the beginning of disarmament, which greatly displeased the military-industrial complex, you could conceivably have an attempt at a coup d'etat. I do not say that I think it likely, but I think even that conceivable. And this is an extra reason, which you will not be warned of, even by the so-called liberals in general. Now you will probably say to me, or some of you, or at least in your hearts you will be thinking, or do you think with your hearts or your heads, or neither. Well, in any case, you will be saying to yourselves, perhaps, well, it may be so, but what else can we do in so dangerous a world? What else can we do? And it's a legitimate question. And I do not profess to stand before you to tell you that there is an easy answer or that I have all the answers. I think I can say with great confidence there is a direction in which you could turn, which would show great light on the shed great light on the situation, that we have by no means done all that we ought to have done to explore the alternatives to war. And you do not answer that by telling me, but look at the Russians. Certainly they haven't done all that they ought, as I shall be willing to admit out of hand. But that does not absolve us. I have heard two secretaries of state, two very able secretaries of the state, who, not too privately, have said that they didn't really believe that disarmament was possible, even if advisable. Even at a time when the administration was conventionally supporting disarmament. Back in 1955, yes, that's when one of the innumerable disarmament conferences found the Russians accepting an Anglo-French proposal backed by us for a reduction of conventional armies in Russia and elsewhere, we rejoiced and adjourned for the summer. And in the fall, the Allies withdrew the offer. In 1957, Stratton in London, faced with the offer of the Russians of a two-year moratorium on tests with inspection, under orders from Washington, he didn't explore what inspection would then mean. He simply declined. Later, it was explained to us that he had to decline because there was no such thing as effective inspection of underground explosions. But it looked very bad to have the United States simply say no. And in the eyes of the world, we had to do something. So we rather hastily offered our own package. We had made four proposals, pretty good proposals if they'd been adopted, but in total requiring a great deal more of the inspection that we said was impossible. One of the proposals was a mild variation of the Russian proposal that we had rejected. Now, Admiral Strauss, at that time head of the AEC, told me that he believed we had to reject the Russian proposal, but said that he accepted the package proposal. No one in Washington would have offered the package proposal except for the certainty that the Russians would refuse, and therefore put us in a better position, they hoped, in the eyes of the world. I could multiply illustrations. I could point out to you that we rejected steadily repeated offers, beginning with the Rapaki offer of the Polish foreign minister for an extension of the principle of demilitarization, which was successfully applied in Austria through Central Europe, and with a phased withdrawal on both sides of troops and military equipment. The offer as it stood might need some modification, but Mr. Dulles and his successors, of course under the approval of the White House, steadily refused even to consider that offer, which would have reduced the Berlin crisis to an easily manageable affair one way or the other. We didn't even consider it. It's only Americans, and I speak with fairly extensive knowledge from traveling and otherwise, it's only we Americans who are persuaded of our complete virtue. The foreigners, I think, are often too suspicious of us. And believe it or not, in foreign countries, you would be surprised to hear the defenses that I have made. For what I believe and not for what I don't believe, for I think we have much that can be defended. But our opinion of ourselves is not shared. I was in the Middle East, for instance, about the time that the Russians successfully launched the first Sputnik. And I was beset by people. I was in a position to see rather important people. And I was beset by a kind of taunt. Now the Russians are ahead of you, even in military power, that they thought was the significance of Sputnik. And they're at least, they're more willing than you to talk peace because they proposed a plan for demilitarization in the Middle East. We don't like the plan too well, but they proposed it and you wouldn't even consider it. I think that it may be doubtful what the Russians wanted at that moment, but this is what happened. We have said that we believed in disarmament, our presidents have, uniformly, but it was only under the Kennedy administration that a really intelligible plan for disarmament was laid on the table at Geneva by us, following the laying on the table of a Russian four-year plan. I am not in a position, none of us have time tonight to discuss details of the plan. I think that a better plan could be worked out than either than the American or Russian plan. But I am simply saying that it was only under the Kennedy administration that this was even filed. Take the matter of tests, a present thing. I don't believe that since all that is involved is the detection now of underground tests, the difference between what the Americans are proposing about stations and what the Russians have said they would accept is important enough to stymie the whole business. I like the American plan better than the Russian. But our obduracy, I think, is equal to the Russian obduracy. And neither side seems to be doing what ought to be done. And here's the alternative to what if we were halfway sane. It is enormously now to the obvious interest of both Messrs. Kennedy and Khrushchev to stop tests and stop in every conceivable way the spread of nuclear weapons. As some of you heard me say rather informally this morning, until now, roughly, you have had a situation in which the dominant factor was the confrontation of two highly armed nuclear powers, ourselves and Russia, each of us possessed of an alliance, more or less, mostly more, subordinate to us because they didn't have nuclear weapons. Now, China is openly challenging Khrushchev, his interpretation of communism, his abrogation of the Leninist doctrine of an inevitable war in the explosion of capitalism. And whatever Khrushchev says, he can't help but being greatly perturbed. Not with perhaps an immediate danger, but with a danger if and when China gets nuclear bombs, as she's bound to sooner or later if this goes on. It'll be hard perhaps to stop her, although they have said they don't approve of nuclear weapons. It'll be hard perhaps to stop her even if the United States and Russia reach an agreement. But if we don't reach an agreement, there's nothing so certain as that China will have them, and Khrushchev knows it. On the other hand, we aren't too well off. De Gaulle, speaking mostly for himself, but he is France for practical purposes, De Gaulle is bound to get nuclear weapons for the grandeur of and safety of France. And he is very contemptuous. Even that France's possession of nuclear weapons shall be diluted by being confined to submarines using Polaris missiles, which we give them at a bargain price, with some strings still on control. This is out. Now we are faced with a dilemma that there is no solution of in an armed world. The most brilliant diplomats can't solve it. For there are two inescapable facts. The first fact is that not only de Gaulle, but more and more the entire West of Europe is going to demand a larger voice in military strategy now that they have got more power, now that they are stronger. On the other hand, it is truer than ever that the dispersal of nuclear weapons, which we have been against, is terribly dangerous, not merely because, not that we may not like our allies, but the more people have these dangerous weapons, the more dangerous it is for everybody. Because the chief dangers do not, in my judgment, arise from calculated use of these weapons, to which many people agree. They arise from accident, to which we are, of course, prone. It's a subject of mathematical inquiry, the probability of accident. It arises from a temporary madness of someone in authority. It arises from gross miscalculation. You make a threat. Step one foot farther and we go to war. And they don't draw back. It arises from perhaps an elaborate design that by a first strike you can win. There's no doubt that the dispersal of nuclear weapons is immensely dangerous, and there's no solution except in disarmament. And disarmament, or at least the beginning, in the stopping of tests, in a halfway sane world, ought to be relatively easy, since it's so greatly to the interest of the major contenders of the past. And if you had a really sane world, What now I shall be told is imaginative would be possible. I do not insist on the form, but in one way or another, not just Kennedy, not just Khrushchev, but both of them would have made a tremendous appeal to the nations at Geneva. This is the time when we save ourselves. We do get an agreement to stop tests, but neither has done it. Rather obviously, they haven't. Kennedy's wished them well, but said we have to have those 7, 8, whatever it is, stations. Khrushchev's men say, no, we've made all the concessions we want, and besides, you Americans are, whatever you say to us about Cuba, what you're doing is keeping a nuclear bases, both for missiles and for submarines in Europe and European waters, and therefore we can't play any farther. And so the world drifts, although it drifts now, contrary to the rational interests of the major powers concerned. And the reason for it is largely, I think, public opinion, especially in the United States. And we, weak as we may be as individuals, somehow make up public opinion. And again, I remind you of what I have been told more than once in Washington. It is, we can't do much more because of the public, because of the public opinion, because of the newspapers and so forth. Senator Clark of Pennsylvania, in my judgment, very much one of our better senators, made a rather notable and very pessimistic speech around New Year's. I only heard part of it on a radio, and unfortunately, we New Yorkers have to get along without newspapers. Senator Clark said that he thought even now that there was a much better chance of getting a test ban treaty with Russia than getting it through the United States Senate, where a third of the senators can block it. And this is because we are supposed to feel as we are, quite largely. I am challenging, in other words, the notion that we've done everything we could, either as a government, as a people, and I am challenging it in the realm of disarmament. I am saying that we have neglected to see what we can do by regional disarmament. For instance, expanding, as I said before, the Austrian demilitarization, expanding the treaty that we have, barring the Antarctic from military experimentation of any sort, under very good arrangements. We haven't even tried to do that sort of thing. We haven't tried to take up de Gaulle's suggestion that one way to control this business was to control the facilities for dispatching bombs. There are so many roads that have not been openly explored. So much that could be done by an imaginative approach by great leaders that isn't being done at all, and this in the field of disarmament. Now, I have been very much opposed to some of my dear friends and colleagues who seem to believe that all you have to do is to get disarmament, or that you can ever get disarmament as a sole road to peace or to the abolition of major wars. You can't. We live in an intertwined set of calculations that have to be made. And to have disarmament, you have to have increasing facilities to substitute, in a largely anarchic world of nations, law for war, just as you had to have in civil life the means of law to supplant blood feuds and the rest. And this requires a strengthening of the UN and an understanding of it. And if you can't strengthen adequately the UN, and I'm not sure that you can by amending the charter now, it requires what Granville Clark, who, by the way, is a most eminent lawyer and a Republican, even the father once of a draft law, what Granville Clark and Louis Sohn, a professor at Harvard Law School, have proposed. Namely, that the UN and the constituent nations set up a disarmament and a world development authority, which would be equipped with powers to have an international police force for dealing with brushfire wars, some powers of independent taxation, and far better powers of adjudication than are now possessed by the nation in which by the UN, in which the Security Council has been rendered largely impotent, and we are dependent upon an assembly where each nation, big and little, has one vote. There are things you can do, and they aren't discussed. I don't even find that so far, that the World Federalists have led a stimulating discussion of what can be done under the present circumstances. So I am saying that not only do we not do what we, have we not done what we might in disarmament, contrary to general opinion, we have not begun to do what we ought in terms of the kind and degree of international authority that has to be set up to give us law, not war. And this authority would be, I assure you, far less than any tight world government would be. There isn't even in our universities, as I travel around, anything like adequate discussion of this problem. And there's a third point that I call to your attention. It's rather ridiculous to assume that you can get the nations to deal as they ought with disarmament and the rest of it if they are continually immersed in crises, crises in China, crises in Berlin, crises, of course, in Cuba, crises in South Vietnam, where we're fighting a jungle war wholly undeclared by Congress in support of a very poor ruler named Diem. Now, you can't have this crisis situation and do much in disarmament. It's not psychologically possible. Yet, if you could get disarmament, many of these crises would fade into insignificance. It is because of their bearing on the arms race and war that they become so very important. Nevertheless, we have to work together on things, not separately. And there has to be a much better approach to crises, which is a continuing matter of diplomacy. And there is no perfect answer, except we have to accept one modest conclusion. Great as is our strength, we have neither the wisdom nor the strength to plague God by the devil's means of atomic war around the world, even in the support of what we think is the better cause. There are some diseases to which the cure may be worse than the disease, and you have to wait for slower processes. Obviously, I cannot take time tonight to discuss the application of this and other considerations to the crises that confront us. I can point out facts like this, that it's fantastic for us to argue that China, after these years, is properly represented in the UN by a general ingloriously driven out, so little of a democrat that he's never dared to trust a plebiscite even in Taiwan. What is represented, of course, is not China, but the 7th American Fleet. And you will not possibly get a satisfactory disarmament agreement without China in. I know how difficult it is, but I also know that we have taken, with a few exceptions, always the stands to make the difficult impossible. It's simply not true that there's nothing that can be done now in negotiation about Berlin, except to keep an absurd status quo for which we were largely responsible when whoever did it left Berlin 100 miles within the Russian-occupied territory. I want to defend West Berlin. You're not going to do it by a world war, and I don't think it's necessary, especially now, perhaps, that they have built that abomination, the Berlin Wall. And so I can run down the line. I admit the danger that Cuba presents all around, but the notion that you can cure it by starting an Algerian-type guerrilla war in Cuba, which might escalate into world war, seems to me rather fantastic. And I get very weary of congressmen and others, Democrat and Republican, who say with some degree of justice how great are the difficulties and dangers, but really have nothing to offer, accept a program that, unless they've got better substitutes, leads to war. We have got to face this problem of crises other than we have under these considerations. And there is still a final line on which we could develop alternatives to war far better than we have. It is a field in which we have done some things that are good. Certainly the Marshall Plan was good, and I could run down the list. Certainly the Peace Corps is good. But by and large, we have not begun to do what ought to be done by a nation as strong as ours and as wise as we think we are, in the struggle that is imposed upon mankind. That is to say, the struggle to conquer the bitter poverty in which two-thirds of the world lives. For centuries and centuries, men have been content to endure an extraordinary bitterness of poverty. They have been content to endure it because they saw really nothing much that could be done. Now we have the revolution of rising expectations, and we have what has been called the great ascent of nations who try to rise out of the abyss of poverty. It'll be extraordinarily difficult, and we haven't begun to face the question what could be done and how it could be done adequately. If there were no organized communism, you'd have this problem. I bow in deference to the real preeminence of this university in the field of Latin American studies, but it is my own conviction that even if there were no communism, organized communism, you would be faced in Latin America with the continuous series of revolts or revolutions, owing partly to economic conditions, which we have up till now fostered and protected on the whole. This is the situation that we face. And here is a great challenge, especially to you of the younger generation. Talk about moral equivalence of war. Of course, the whole challenge of space developed in peace is one. But of course, the abolition of preventable poverty and illiteracy and disease, this is another. It won't be easy, it can be done. We spend, for instance, the latest UN figures that I remember were $120 billion a year, nations rich and poor, on war. Imagine what could be done by the diversion of that or a large part of that to the works of peace and the conquest of poverty and illiteracy. It can't be done by money alone. It requires service of men and women and devoted men and women, and it requires cooperation. It requires, my friend Seymour Melman of Columbia has been pointing out, a peace race instead of a war race. And he and others have already made a beginning to show that it is possible to make the transition to a peace race out of a war economy. This is something on which we have to put our reliance. I think I shall close by using a figure, an illustration, which I should like to improve, but so far I haven't been able to. I think the lifeline to peace in the sense of absence of major war, is to be braided out of four very strong strands, which briefly I've reviewed. Disarmament down to a police level for preventing wars in and between nations. A strengthening of international federated authority, not the omnipotent world government, the UN and whatever it may set up, to give us progressively in this field, law, not war. A progressive attack on the crises of our time. A progressive disengagement in orderly fashion from dubious commitments beyond our wisdom and beyond our strength. And finally, this holy war against poverty. I think it can be done. Not easily. Just to assure you that I am aware of how grave is the problem, I will tell you what I think I've already said on this campus. I am accused too often in questions of being too optimistic, or that I'm less questioned. Oh, no, I'm nice and pessimistic. I think that if I lived on a planet or a star possessed of full facilities to view the human race as we view on Earth a horse race, I would bet on disaster. It looks that way, given the kind of people that I'm looking at and their institutions, and their failure to match their extraordinary progress in physics and science with their skill in managing themselves and their institutions. I think I'd bet as a neutral observer on disaster. I wouldn't give too big odds because, as I have often said, humanity has had a way of frustrating its critics within. But you and I don't live on this earth, on this distant planet. We do live on this little earth in one of the lesser solar systems in the vastness of space. But it's very important to us what's done. We've got nothing to bet with except our lives. And we can, I think, find a kind of richness in discovering ways ourselves and in association through various societies and political arrangements. We can find ways to bet our lives that it is possible to coexist while we work out the elements that will turn coexistence prompted by a desire to live into a richer and fuller peace. I assure you that I do not believe that we are damned to the extinction that we now can bring upon ourselves by our own inventions. I do not think we are damned to that extinction, either by the gods we profess to worship or by the genes which carry our inheritance. Thank you.
At this time, Dr. Thomas will answer any questions from the audience.
You better tell him that you're going to take them, recognize them, and you will repeat. Yes.